Miss Rose. Miss Rose kept an eye on Eliza with more curiosity than compassion. She knew the symptoms well, and in her experience, time and obstacles extinguish even the most stubborn fires of love. She had been barely 16 when she'd fallen head over heels in love with a Viennese tenor. She was living in England at that time and dreamed of being a diva despite the stubborn opposition of her mother and her brother Jeremy, who had been the head of the family since their father's death. Neither of them considered the opera to be a desirable occupation for a lady, principally because it was performed in theaters at night and wearing low-cut gowns. Nor could she count on the support of her brother John, who had joined the Navy and showed up at home barely a couple of times a year, always in a rush. Exuberant and tanned by the sun of far-off lands, and exhibiting some new tattoo or scar, he would always manage to disrupt the routines of the small family. He handed out gifts, dazzled them with his exotic tales, and immediately disappeared into the red light district, where he stayed until the moment to ship out again. The Summers were country gentry without any great ambitions. They had owned land for several generations, but the father, bored with dumb sheep and poor harvests, had wanted to try his fortunes in London. He loved books so much that he was quite capable of depriving his family of food and going into debt to acquire first editions signed by his favorite authors. But he lacked the greed of dyed-in-the-wool collectors. After fruitless ventures into commerce, he decided to give rein to his true vocation and ended by opening a shop for antiquarian books and others he published himself. In the back of the bookstore, he set up a small press, which he operated with the help of two assistants, and in an upstairs room of the same shop, his trade in rare books grew at a snail's pace. Of his three children, only Rose shared his interests. She grew up with a passion for music and reading, and when she was not sitting at the piano or doing her voice exercises, they could find her in a corner, reading. Her father lamented that Rose was the one who loved books, and not Jeremy or John, who could have inherited his business. At his death, the male heirs liquidated the press and bookshop. John went off to sea, and Jeremy took over the care of his widowed mother and his sister. He earned a modest salary as an employee of the British Import and Export Company Limited, and had a small income from his father, in addition to his brother John's sporadic contributions, which often arrived in the form of contraband instead of negotiable currency. Jeremy, scandalized, would store those accursed boxes in the garret, unopened, until the next visit of his brother, who then took responsibility for selling the contents. The family moved to modest chambers that were expensive for their means, but well situated in the heart of London. Jeremy considered it a good investment. They must marry Rose well. At 16, the girl's beauty began to flower, and there were suitors to spare, well-placed and prepared to die of love. But while her friends busied themselves looking for husbands, Rose was looking for a singing master, which was how she met Karl Bretzner, a Viennese tenor who had come to London to perform in several Mozart works, which were to culminate one stellar night in the marriage of Figaro with the royal family in attendance. Bretzner's appearance revealed nothing of his enormous talent. He looked like a butcher. His physique, barrel-chested but thin in the pins, lacked elegance, and his ruddy face, topped with a mass of salt-and-pepper curls, added up to a rather vulgar whole. But when he opened his mouth to delight the world with the torrent of his voice, he was transformed into a different creature. He grew taller, his pot belly was sucked up into the cavern of his chest, and his Teutonic apoplectic face was filled with Olympic light. At least that was how he was seen by Rose Summers, who was able to get tickets for every performance. She would come to the theater long before it opened, and defying the scandalized glances of passers-by, little accustomed to seeing a girl of her class unaccompanied, wait at the actor's entrance for hours to catch a glimpse of the maestro getting out of his carriage. On Sunday night, the man noticed the beauty stationed in the street and went over to speak to her. Trembling, she answered his questions and confessed her admiration for him and her wishes to follow in his footsteps in the arduous but divine path of bel canto, to use her words. Come to my dressing room after the performance, and we shall see what I can do for you," he said in his precious, strongly Austrian-accented voice. And that she did, walking on air. When the standing ovation faded, an usher sent by Carl Bretzner led Rose behind the wings. She had never seen the inner workings of a theater, but she wasted no time admiring the ingenious machines for making storms or the painted landscapes on the drops. Her only goal was to meet her idol. She found him enveloped in a gold-trimmed, royal blue dressing gown, still wearing his makeup and an elaborate wig of white curls. The usher closed the door and left them alone. The room, crammed with mirrors, furniture, and draperies, smelled of tobacco, stage makeup, and mold. In one corner stood a screen painted with scenes of rosy, fleshed women in a Turkish harem, and costumes on clothes racks lined the walls. Seeing her idol so near, Rose's enthusiasm flagged for a few moments, but he soon regained the lost ground. He took her hands in his, lifted them to his lips, and kissed them slowly. Then, from deep in his chest, voiced a "doh" that rattled the screen of the odalisques. Rose's last hesitations crumbled like the walls of Jericho in the cloud of powder that rose from the wig as the artist peeled it from his head with a passionate, virile gesture and tossed it upon a chair where it lay as inert as a dead rabbit. His hair was crushed beneath a tightly knit hairnet that, added to the makeup, lent him the air of an aged courtesan. Upon the same chaise lounge where the wig had landed, Rose would offer Bretzner her virginity a couple of days afterward, at exactly 3:15 in the afternoon. The Viennese tenor had made a date with her, using the pretext of showing her the theater that Tuesday when there was no performance. They met secretly in a tea room, where he delicately savored 5 cream eclairs and 2 cups of chocolate while she stirred her tea, so frightened and excited she couldn't swallow. From there, they went straight to the theater. At that hour, there was no one around but 2 women cleaning the foyer and a man readying the oil lamps, torches, and candles for the following day. Carl Bretzner, skilled in the perils of love, produced a bottle of champagne with a magician's dexterity and poured each of them a glass, which they drank down in a toast to Mozart and Rossini. He then installed Rose in the imperial plush box where only the king sat, every inch of which was adorned with chubby cupids and overblown roses, then went down to the stage. Standing on a segment of painted plaster column, lighted by the footlamps, he sang for her alone an aria from The Barber of Seville, displaying all his vocal agility and the soft delirium of his voice with endless embellishments. As the last note of his homage faded, he heard the distant sobs of Rose Summers. With unexpected agility, he ran toward her. Crossing the hall, he gained the box in 2 bounds and fell to his knees at her feet. Breathless, he laid his large head upon the girl's skirt, burying his face in folds of moss-colored silk. He wept with her because, without intending it, he, too, had fallen in love. What had begun as yet another fleeting conquest had in a few hours been transformed into incandescent passion. Rose and Carl got to their feet, supporting one another, stumbling, terrified before the inevitable, and with no idea how, they walked down a long corridor in darkness, climbed a short staircase, and reached the area of the dressing rooms. The cursive letters of the tenor's name marked one of the doors. They went into the room cluttered with furniture and dusty, sweaty costumes where they had been alone for the first time only 2 days before. The room had no windows, and for a moment, they sank into the refuge of darkness, recovering breath lost in sobs and sighs, while he lighted first a match and then the 5 candles of a candelabrum. In the trembling yellow light of the flames, they admired one another, confused and clumsy, filled with a torrent of emotions, but unable to articulate a single word. Rose could not withstand the eyes stripping her bare and hid her face in her hands. But he pulled them away with the same delicacy he had earlier used to demolish the cream pastries. They began with tiny, tear-wet kisses, dove pecks, which developed naturally into serious kisses. Rose had experienced tender but very hesitant and hasty encounters from some of her suitors, and one or two of them had managed to brush her cheek with his lips. But she had never imagined it possible to reach such a degree of intimacy that another's tongue could wind around hers like a lewd snake, or that she could be slathered with someone else's saliva externally and invaded internally. But her initial repugnance was soon conquered by the stimulus of youth and her enthusiasm for the lyrical. Not only did she return Bretzner's caresses with equal intensity, she took the initiative by removing her hat and the short gray caracal cape around her shoulders. From there to allowing him to unbutton her jacket and then her blouse was but a few capitulations. She was able to follow the mating dance step by step, guided by instinct as well as the forbidden books she had furtively pulled from her father's shelves. That was the most memorable day of her life, and she would remember it, adorned and exaggerated, in the most minute detail in the years to come. That was to be her source of experience and knowledge, the fount of inspiration for nourishing her fantasies, and years later, for creating the art that would make her famous in certain very secret circles. That marvelous day she could compare in intensity with only one other, 2 years later, in Valparaiso, in March, when the newborn Eliza fell into her arms as consolation for the children she would never have, for the men she would never love, and for the hearth she would never call hers. The Viennese tenor turned out to be a very refined lover. He loved and knew women to their marrow, but he was able to erase from his memory the relics of past loves, the frustrations of multiple farewells, the jealousies, disasters, and deceptions of other relationships, and give himself with complete innocence to his brief passion for Rose Summers. His experience had not come from pathetic embraces with squalid whores. Bretzner prided himself on never having had to pay for pleasure. Because women of varied station, from humble chambermaids to arrogant countesses, gave themselves to him unconditionally after they heard him sing. He learned the arts of love at the same time he learned those of singing. He was 10 when he fell in love with the person who was to be his mentor, a Frenchwoman, old enough to be his mother, with the eyes of a tigress and breasts of pure alabaster. She, in turn, had been initiated at the age of 13 in France by Donatien Alphonse François de Sade. Daughter of a jailer in the Bastille, she had met the famous Marquis in the filthy cell in which he wrote his perverse stories by the light of a candle. She used to watch him through the bars with a child's simple curiosity, unaware that her father had sold her to the prisoner in exchange for a gold watch, the impoverished noble's last possession. One morning when she was peering through the peephole in the cell door, her father took the large ring of keys from his waist, opened the door, and, as one feeds a lion his prey, with a push, thrust the girl into the cell. What happened there, she could not remember. It was enough to know that she stayed with de Sade, following him from jail to the worst poverty of freedom, learning everything he had to teach her. When in 1802 the Marquis was locked up in the madhouse of Charenton, she was left on her own without a centime, but with a vast storehouse of amatory wisdom that helped her win a husband 52 years older than she and very wealthy. He died not long after, exhausted by the excesses of his young wife, and she finally was free and with money to do whatever she wished. She was 34 years old. She had survived her brutal apprenticeship at the side of the Marquis, the poverty of bread crusts in her childhood, the turmoil of the French Revolution, the terror of the Napoleonic Wars, and now she had to put up with the dictatorial repression of the Empire. She had had enough. Her spirit yearned for a truce. She decided to look for a safe place to spend the rest of her days in peace and chose Vienna. It was during this period in her life that she met Karl Bretzner, her neighbor's son. He was barely 10, but even by then he was singing like a nightingale in the cathedral choir. Thanks to her, now the friend and confidant of the Bretzners, the boy was not, as the choir director had recommended, castrated that year to preserve his cherubic voice. "Do not touch him," And before you know it, he will be the best-paid tenor in Europe, she predicted. She was not mistaken. Despite the enormous discrepancy in age, an unusual relationship developed between the woman and the young Carl. She admired the boy's purity of sentiment and his dedication to music. In her, he found the muse who not only saved his manhood, but also taught him how to use it. By the time his voice had changed and he had begun to shave, he had mastered the eunuch's proverbial talent in pleasing a woman in ways not foreseen by nature and custom. But with Rose Summers, he took no risks. No fierce assault and a flurry of overly daring caresses, for this was not a time to shock with tricks of the seraglio, he decided, never suspecting that in less than 3 practical lessons, his student would surpass him in inventiveness. He was a man who was careful about details, and he knew the hallucinatory power of le mot juste in the hour of love. With his left hand, he undid one by one the small mother-of-pearl buttons down Rose's back, while with the right, he took the pins from her hair, never losing the rhythm of kisses interspersed with a stream of compliments. He spoke of the smallness of her waist, the pristine whiteness of her skin, the classic roundness of her throat and shoulders, all of which, he said, kindled a fire in him, an uncontrollable madness. I am deranged. I do not know what is happening to me. Never have I, never shall I, love anyone as I do you. This is the miraculous meeting of 2 souls destined never to part, he murmured again and again. He recited his entire repertoire, but without hypocrisy, deeply convinced of his own honesty and dazzled by Rose. He untied the strings of her corset and removed petticoats until she was wearing only her long batiste underdrawers and a sheer camisole that revealed the strawberries of her nipples. He did not remove her high-laced kid shoes with the curved heels or the white stockings fastened at her knees with embroidered garters. At that point he stopped, panting, with a planetary clamor in his breast, convinced that Rose Summers was the most beautiful woman in the universe, an angel, and that his heart was going to explode and scatter him in pieces if he did not calm himself. He picked her up effortlessly, crossed the room, and stood her before a large mirror with a golden frame. The winking light of the candles and the theatrical wardrobe on the walls, a confusion of brocades, feathers, velvets, and faded laces, gave the scene an air of unreality. Disarmed, drunk with emotion, Rose looked at herself in the mirror and did not recognize that woman in her undergarments, her hair wild and cheeks aflame, whom some man, also unrecognizable, was kissing on the neck as he greedily fondled her breasts. That avid interlude gave the tenor time to catch his breath and some of the lucidity he had lost during their preliminary skirmishes. He began taking off his clothes, facing the mirror, uninhibited, and, it must be said, looking much better out of his clothes than in them. He needs a good tailor, Rose thought. She had never seen a naked man, not even her brothers as children, and her information was based on overblown descriptions in the racy books and Japanese postcards she had discovered in her Uncle John's luggage, in which the male organs were depicted in frankly optimistic proportions. The rosy, perky gherkin revealed before her eyes did not frighten her, as Carl Bretzner had feared, but instead provoked irrepressible and joyful giggles, and that set the tone for what followed. Instead of the solemn, rather doleful ceremony a deflowering can be, they pleasured themselves in playful caperings, chasing one another around the room, hopping over furniture like children. They drank the rest of the champagne and opened another bottle to spray one another with bubbling foam. Risqué phrases rolled out with laughter. Whispers brought oaths of love as they bit and licked and frolicked in the bottomless tidal pool of newly discovered love, all through the afternoon and well into the night, without a thought for the time or for the rest of the universe. Only they existed. The Viennese tenor led Rose to epic heights, and she, a diligent student, followed without hesitation and once, at the summit, took wing on her own with surprising natural talent, guided by signs and asking what she could not guess, dazzling her maestro and finally besting him with her improvised skills and the annihilating gift of her love. When they could bear to pull themselves apart and return to reality, the clock showed 10 o'clock. The theater was empty, darkness ruled outside, and to top everything off, a fog thick as meringue had settled in. A frenetic exchange began between the lovers. Notes, flowers, bonbons, copied verses, and small sentimental trinkets that lasted as long as the season in London. They met where they could. Passion caused them to lose all prudence. To gain time, they looked for hotel rooms near the theater, indifferent to the possibility of being recognized. Rose escaped the house with ridiculous excuses, but her terrified mother said nothing to Jeremy of her suspicions, praying that her daughter's madness was temporary and would disappear without leaving a mark. Carl Bretzner came late to rehearsals, and from whipping off his clothes at any hour, he caught a cold and missed 2 performances. Far from being sorry, he used the time for lovemaking enhanced by feverish chills. He would come to the rented room with flowers for Rose, champagne to drink and to bathe in, cream pastries, poems written on the fly to read in bed, aromatic oils to rub into places until then sealed, erotic books they paged through seeking the most inspiring scenes, ostrich feathers for tickling, and countless other props for their games. The girl felt that she was opening like a carnivorous flower, emitting demonic perfumes to attract her man like a Venus's flytrap, crushing him, swallowing him, digesting him, and finally spitting out the splinters of his bones. She was suffused with unbearable energy. She was drowning. She could not sit quiet an instant, devoured with impatience. In the meantime, Carl Bretzner was floundering in confusion, at times uplifted to the point of frenzy, at others drained, trying to meet his musical obligations, but he was deteriorating in full view, and the critics, implacable, said that Mozart whirled in his grave when he heard the Viennese tenor execute, literally, his compositions. With panic, the lovers watched the moment of parting draw near and entered the phase of love obstructed. They discussed running away to Brazil or committing suicide together, but the possibility of marriage was never mentioned. In the end, the appetite for life was stronger than the temptation of tragedy, and after Bretzner's last performance, they hired a carriage and traveled to a seaside hotel in the north of England. They had decided to enjoy a few days in anonymity before Carl Bretzner went ahead to Italy to honor his contracts. Rose would meet him in Vienna once he found appropriate lodgings, got settled, and sent money for the journey. They were breakfasting beneath an awning on the terrace of their small hotel, legs covered with a wool blanket because of the sharp, cold air of the coast, when they were interrupted by Jeremy Summers, indignant and solemn as a prophet. Rose had left such a clear trail that it had been easy for her older brother to follow and find her in this out-of-the-way resort. When she saw him, her cry was more one of surprise than fear, emboldened as she was by the tumult of her love. At that instant, she felt for the first time a sense of what she had done, and the weight of the consequences was revealed in all its magnitude. She rose to her feet, resolved to defend her right to live her life however she pleased, but her brother cut her off before she could speak, directing his remarks to the tenor. "You owe my sister an explanation. I suppose you have not told her that you are married and that you have 2 children," he sputtered to the seducer. That was the one thing Carl Bretzner had failed to tell Rose. They had talked themselves out. He had confessed even the most intimate details of previous love affairs, not overlooking the excesses of the Marquis de Sade that his mentor, the French woman with the eyes of a tiger, had described to him, because Rose had demonstrated a morbid curiosity to know when, with whom, and especially how he had made love from the time he was 10 until the day before he met her. And once he learned how much she liked listening to him and how she incorporated the information into her own theory and practice, he told her everything without reservation. But of his wife and children, he had said nothing, out of compassion for this beautiful virgin who had given herself to him unconditionally. He hadn't wanted to destroy the magic of that coming together. Rose Summers deserved to enjoy her first love to the fullest. "You owe me satisfaction," Jeremy Summers challenged, slapping Bretzner across the face with his glove. Carl Bretzner was a man of the world, and he had no intention of doing anything as barbaric as fight a duel. He understood that the moment had come for him to retreat, and he regretted not having a few moments in private to try to explain things to Rose. He did not want to leave her with a broken heart, or with the idea that he had seduced her in bad conscience only to abandon her. He needed to tell her once more how much he truly loved her, and that he was sorry he was not free to live out their dreams. But he saw in Jeremy Summers' face that he would not allow that. Jeremy took the arm of his sister, who seemed stupefied, and led her firmly to the carriage, denying her the opportunity to say goodbye to her lover or to collect her few belongings. He drove her to the home of an aunt in Scotland, where she was to stay until her condition could be determined. If the worst happened, which was how Jeremy referred to a possible pregnancy, her life and the honor of the family would be forever besmirched. "Not a word of this to anyone, not even to Mama or John, you understand," were the only words he spoke during the journey. Rose lived a few weeks of uncertainty until she knew that she was not pregnant. That brought a sigh of enormous relief, as if the heavens had absolved her. As atonement, she spent 3 months knitting for the poor, reading and writing on the sly, without shedding a single tear. During that time, she reflected on her fate, and something shifted inside, because when she left her aunt's home, she was a different person. Only Rose was aware of the change. She reappeared in London exactly as she had left, smiling, tranquil, interested in opera and literature, without a word of bitterness to Jeremy for having dragged her from the arms of her lover, or of nostalgia for the man who had deceived her, Olympian in her posture of ignoring gossip and the mournful faces of her family. On the surface, she seemed the same girl she had always been. Not even her mother could find the chink in her perfect composure that would allow her a reproach or counsel. On the other hand, the widow was not in a situation to help or protect her daughter. A cancer was rapidly devouring her. The one modification in Rose's behavior was her fancy for spending hours closed in her room, writing. In her tiny hand, she filled dozens of notebooks, which she kept under lock and key. As she never tried to post a letter, Jeremy Summers, who feared nothing so much as ridicule, stopped worrying about the vice of writing and assumed that his sister had had the good judgment to forget the ill-omened Viennese tenor. Not only had she not forgotten him, however, she remembered with noonday clarity every detail of what had happened and each word he had spoken or whispered. The only thing she erased from her mind was the disenchantment of having been deceived. Carl Bretzner's wife and children simply disappeared, because they had never been given a place in the vast fresco of her memories of love. Rose's retreat to her aunt's home in Scotland had not eliminated gossip, but as the rumors could not be confirmed, no one dared openly snub the family. One by one, the many suitors who had besieged Rose returned, but she sent them away, using the excuse of her mother's illness. Things kept quiet simply never happened, Jeremy Summers maintained, eager to snuff out every vestige of that episode with silence. Rose's shameful escapade lived on in the limbo of things not given words, although at times the brother and sister made oblique references that kept their rancor alive, but also united them in the shared secret. Years later, when it no longer mattered to anyone, Rose dared tell her brother John, with whom she had always played the role of the spoiled and innocent little girl. Shortly after the death of their mother, Jeremy Summers was offered the directorship of the British Import and Export Company Limited in Chile. He left with his sister Rose, carrying the secret with them, intact, to the other side of the world. They arrived in Valparaiso at the end of the winter of 1830, when that city was still a hamlet, even though there were already European companies and families there. For Rose, their destination was a punishment, and she assumed it stoically, resigned to pay for her misstep with that inescapable exile, though not allowing anyone, most of all her brother Jeremy, to suspect her desperation. her discipline in not complaining and not talking, even in her dreams, about her lost lover, sustained her when she was beset with difficulties. They moved into the best available hotel, wanting to guard against winds and humidity because of an epidemic of diphtheria, which the local barbers combated with cruel and futile surgical interventions they performed with their razors. Spring and then summer somewhat improved Rose's bad impression of Chile. She determined to forget about London and make the best of her new surroundings, despite the provincial atmosphere and the sea winds that pierced one's bones on even the sunniest days. She convinced her brother, and he his office, of the need to acquire a decent house in the firm's name and to ship furniture from England. She presented it as a matter of authority and prestige. It was unthinkable that the representative of such an important office should be lodging in a rundown hotel. 18 months later, when baby Eliza came into their lives, brother and sister were living in a large house on Cerro Alegre. Miss Rose had relegated her former lover to a sealed compartment of her memory and was wholly dedicated to winning a prominent position in local society. In the following years, Valparaíso grew in size and was modernized at the same pace that Rose left her past behind to become the exuberant, happy-appearing woman who, 11 years later, would enslave Jacob Todd. The false missionary was not the first to be rejected, but Miss Rose had no interest in marrying. She had discovered an extraordinary formula for never emerging from her idyllic romance with Carl Bretzner, reliving each and every moment of their incendiary passion, along with fantasies she invented in the silence of her spinster nights. Love. No one better than Miss Rose could know what was happening in Eliza's lovesick soul. She immediately guessed the man's identity, because only a blind man could have missed the connection between the girl's bizarre behavior and the delivery by her brother's employee of the crates of treasures for Feliciano Rodriguez de Santa Cruz. Her first impulse had been to write off the young man as a nonentity, too poor to be significant, but she quickly realized that she herself had sensed his dangerous attraction and had not stopped thinking about him. Naturally, she had first focused on his mended clothing and mournful pallor, but a second look had been enough to appreciate his aura, the tragic, damned poet. Furiously embroidering in her sewing room, she kept mulling over the reversal of fate that was affecting her plans to find Eliza a congenial and wealthy husband. In her thoughts, she wove a web of plots to nip that love in the bud before it began— from sending Eliza to a boarding school for girls in England or to her own ancient aunt in Scotland, to pouring out the truth to her brother so he would fire his employee. In the depths of her heart, however, quite despite herself, was germinating the secret hope that Eliza could live out her passion to the end, to compensate for the fathomless void the tenor had left in her own life 18 years before. In the meantime, for Eliza, the hours passed with paralyzing slowness in a whirl of confused emotions. She didn't know whether it was day or night, Tuesday or Friday, whether it had been a few hours or several years since she'd met that young man. She felt that her blood had turned to froth, and she broke out in hives that faded as suddenly and inexplicably as they had appeared. She saw her beloved everywhere, in the shadows of the corners, in the shapes of the clouds, in her teacup, and most of all, in her dreams. She did not know his name, but did not dare ask Jeremy Summers, because that would unleash a wave of suspicions. But she entertained herself for hours imagining an appropriate name for him. She needed desperately to talk with someone about her love, to analyze every detail of his brief visit, to speculate on what they should have said to each other and what they had communicated with glances, blushes, and designs. But she had no one in whom to confide. She longed for a visit from Captain John Summers, that uncle with the heart of a buccaneer, who had been the most fascinating character in her childhood, the only one capable of understanding and helping in such a difficult time. She had no doubt at all that if Jeremy Summers got wind of her feelings, he would declare all-out war on his firm's humble employee, and she could not predict Miss Rose's reaction. She decided that the less that was known in her home, the more she and her future sweetheart would be free to act. She never imagined a scenario in which her love was not returned with the same depth of feeling, for to her it was impossible to believe that a love of such magnitude could have stunned only her. The most elementary logic and justice indicated that somewhere in the city he was suffering the same delicious torment. Eliza hid to touch her body in secret places she had never explored before. She closed her eyes, and then it was his hand that caressed her with the delicacy of a bird. His lips she kissed in the mirror. His waist she embraced around the pillow. His the murmurs of love carried to her on the wind. Not even her dreams escaped the power of Joaquin Andieta. She would see him appear like a huge shadow looming over her and devouring her in a thousand outlandish and disturbing ways. Moon, calf, devil, archangel, she didn't know. She did not want to wake, and with fanatic determination, she practiced the skill learned from Mama Frisia for entering and leaving dreams at will. She came to have such mastery of this art that her illusory lover appeared in bodily form. She could touch him, smell him, and hear his voice perfectly clear and close by. If only she could always be asleep, she would need nothing more, she thought. She could go on loving him from her bed through eternity. She would have perished in the delirium of that passion if Joaquin Andieta hadn't come to the house a week later to pick up the boxes of treasures being sent to their client in the north. She learned the night before that he was coming, not through instinct or premonition, as she would imply years later when she told Dao Qian the story, but because at dinner she heard Jeremy Summers giving instructions to his sister and Mama Frisia. "The same employee who brought the load will come to get it," he added in passing, never suspecting the hurricane of emotions his words, for different reasons, unleashed among the three women. The girl spent the morning on the terrace, her eyes glued to the road rising up the hill toward the house. About midday, she saw the cart pulled by six mules and followed by armed peons on horseback. She felt an icy peace, as if she had died, unaware that Miss Rose and Mama Frisia were watching her from the house. "All that I have invested in educating her, and she falls in love with the first good-for-nothing who crosses her path," muttered Miss Rose. She had decided to do whatever she could to forestall disaster, but without much conviction, because she knew too well the obstinate temper of first love. "I will take him to the cargo. Tell Eliza to go in the house and don't let her come out for any reason," she ordered. "And how do you want me to do that?" Mama Frisia asked, grumbling. "Lock her up if you have to." "You lock her up if you can. Don't get me into it," she replied and left, bedroom slippers slapping. There was no way to keep the girl from going up to Joaquin Andieta and handing him a letter. She did it openly, looking him in the eye, and with such fierce determination that Miss Rose did not have the gall to intercept her, or Mama Frisia to stand in her way. Then the women understood that the sorcery was much stronger than they had imagined, and that no locked door or blessed candles were enough to break the spell. The young man also had spent that week obsessed with the memory of the girl whom he believed was the daughter of his employer, Jeremy Summers, and therefore far beyond his reach. He had no inkling of the impression he had made, and it never crossed his mind that by offering him that memorable glass of juice on his first visit, she was declaring her love. As a result, he was wildly surprised when she handed him a sealed envelope. Disconcerted, he slipped the envelope into his pocket and continued to supervise the task of loading the boxes into the cart. As his ears burned, his clothes grew damp with sweat, and a fever of shivers ran down his spine. Motionless and silent, Eliza watched closely from a few steps away, ignoring Miss Rose's furious and Mama Frisia's remorseful expressions. When the last crate was tied onto the cart and the mules turned to head down the hill, Joaquin apologized to Miss Rose for the nuisance, greeted Eliza with a brief nod of his head, and left as quickly as he could. Eliza's note contained only two lines, telling him where and how to meet her. The strategy was of such simplicity and boldness that she might have been taken as an expert in duplicity. Joaquin was to present himself 3 days hence on Cerro Alegre at 9 p.m. in the shrine of the Vergen del Perpetuo Socor, a chapel built a short distance from the Summers' home as a haven for travelers on foot. Eliza had chosen that place because it was near and the date because it was Wednesday. Miss Rose, Mama Frisia, and the servants would be busy with dinner and no one would notice if she slipped out for a while. After the departure of the crestfallen Michael Stewart, there had been no reason for dances, and the premature winter was not conducive to them. But Miss Rose maintained the custom in order to deflate the gossip circulating about her and the Navy officer. To have suspended the musical evenings in Stewart's absence would have been equivalent to confessing that he was the only reason for holding them. By 7, Joaquin Andieta was already waiting impatiently. In the distance, he saw the glow of bright lights from the house, the parade of carriages bringing guests, and the torches of the coachman waiting along the road. Once or twice he had to hide as watchmen came by to check the lamps on top of the shrine, which the wind kept blowing out. The building was a small adobe rectangle, only slightly larger than a confessional, topped with a painted wood cross and housing a plaster image of the Virgin. A tray held rows of burned-down votive candles and a vase containing withered flowers. There was a full moon, but the sky was striped with clouds that from time to time completely blacked out the moonlight. At 9 exactly, he felt the girl's presence and saw her silhouette, cloaked from head to foot in a dark mantle. "I have been waiting for you, señorita," was all he could think to stammer, feeling like an idiot. "I have been waiting for you," she replied without the least hesitation. She threw back her mantle, and Joaquin saw she was dressed for a party, though her skirt was tucked up, and she was wearing rough sandals. She was carrying her white stockings and chamois dancing slippers to keep from muddying them on the road. Her black hair, parted in the center, was caught back on both sides of her head into braids decorated with satin ribbons. They sat at the back of the shrine on the mantle that she lay on the floor, hidden behind the statue, unspeaking, very close, but not touching. For a long time, they lacked the courage to look at one another in the soft shadows, stupefied by their closeness, breathing the same air, and aflame despite the cold wind that threatened to leave them in blackness. "My name is Eliza Summers," she said finally. "And I am Joaquin Andieta," he replied. "I thought maybe your name was Sebastian."
"Why?"
"Because you look like Saint Sebastian the Martyr. I don't go to the Papist Church. I am a Protestant, but Mama Frisia has sometimes taken me when she goes to make promises to her saints." The conversation ended there because they didn't know what else to say. They stole glances out of the corners of their eyes and then blushed in unison. Eliza could smell his scent of soap and sweat, but didn't dare move closer to sniff him as she wanted to. The only sounds in the shrine were the whispering wind and their agitated breathing. After a few minutes, Eliza announced that she had to go back to the house before she was missed, and they said goodbye, brushing hands. They met the next few Wednesdays, always at a different time and for only brief intervals. In each of these tumultuous meetings, they moved forward with giant steps through the delirium and torment of love. Hurriedly, they told each other what was indispensable to tell, because words seemed a waste of time. Soon they held hands and kept on talking, their bodies closer and closer as their souls moved toward each other, until on the night of the fifth Wednesday, they kissed on the lips, first tentatively, then exploring, and finally losing themselves in pleasure until the fever consuming them was totally unleashed. By then they had exchanged abbreviated summaries of Eliza's 16 years and Joaquin's 21. They discussed the improbable basket with batiste sheets and mink coverlet, in contrast to the Marseille soap crate, and it came as a relief to Andieta that Eliza was not the daughter of either Summers, but was, like him, born of obscure origins, although they were still separated by a social and economic abyss. Eliza learned that Joaquin was the fruit of a passing ravishment. His father had vanished as quickly as he had sown his seed, and the boy had grown up not knowing his father's name, carrying his mother's, and marked as a bastard, limited at every turn of the road. The family drove their dishonored daughter from their bosom and disregarded the illegitimate son. His grandparents and his uncles, merchants and minor civil servants in a middle class mired in prejudice, lived in the same city, only a few blocks away, but their paths never crossed. On Sundays they went to the same church, but at different hours, because the poor never went to noon mass. Branded by the stigma, Joaquin never played in the same parks or went to the schools his cousins attended, although he wore their old clothes and played with their discarded toys, which a kind-hearted aunt sent to her banished sister through convoluted means. Joaquin Andieta's mother had been less fortunate than Miss Rose and had paid more dearly for her weakness. The women were about the same age, but while the English lady looked young, the other was worn down by poverty, consumption, and the dismal task of embroidering bridal gowns by candlelight. Bad luck had not diminished her dignity, and she brought up her son with inviolable principles of honor. Joaquin had learned at a very early age to hold his head high, defying any glimmer of mockery or pity. "One day I will take my mother out of the shack she lives in," Joaquin vowed during their whispered conversations in the shrine. "I will give her a decent life, like the one she had before she lost everything."
"She didn't lose everything. She has a son," Eliza replied.
"I was her misfortune."
"Her misfortune was to fall in love with a bad man. You are her redemption," she declared.
The meetings between the two young people were very brief and never at the same hour, and Miss Rose could not watch Eliza day and night. She knew something was happening behind her back, but she could not go so far as to lock Eliza in her room or send her to the country as duty prescribed, and she refrained from mentioning her suspicions to her brother Jeremy. She was sure that Eliza and her beloved were exchanging letters, but was never able to intercept one, though she alerted all the servants. The letters did exist and were of such intensity that had Miss Rose seen them, she would have been appalled. Joaquin never sent them. He handed them to Eliza at each of their meetings. In the most feverish language, he told her what he did not dare in person, out of pride and propriety. She hid the letters in a box buried 30 centimeters deep in the small kitchen garden by the house, where every day she pretended to be diligently weeding Mama Frisia's vegetables and medicinal herbs. Those pages, reread 1,000 times in stolen moments, were the principal sustenance of her passion, because they revealed an aspect of Joaquin Andieta that did not emerge when they were together. They seemed written by a different person. That haughty young man, always on the defensive, somber and tormented, who embraced her madly and then pushed her away as if burned by the contact, in writing opened the floodgates of his soul and described his emotions like a poet. Later, when for years Eliza would follow Joaquin Andieta's faint trail, those letters would be her only grasp on the truth, irrefutable proof that their delirious love was not an invention of her adolescent imagination, but that it was real, a brief blessing and an extended torment. After the first Wednesday in the shrine, Eliza's attacks of indigestion vanished without a trace, and nothing in her behavior or her appearance revealed her secret, except the demented gleam in her eyes and a more frequent use of her talent for making herself invisible. At times, she gave the impression of being in several places at once, confusing everyone, or it might be that no one could remember where or when they had last seen her, and just as they started to call her, she would materialize with the air of someone who doesn't know anyone was looking for her. She spent time with Miss Rose in her sewing room or cooking with Mama Frisia, but she had become so quiet and transparent that neither woman felt she was seeing her. Her presence was subtle, nearly imperceptible, and when she went away, no one realized it until hours later. "You're like a ghost. I'm tired of looking for you. I don't want you to leave the house, not even leave my sight," Miss Rose ordered again and again. "I've been here all afternoon," Eliza would reply, undaunted, quietly appearing in a corner with a book or embroidery in her hand. "Make some noise, child, por Dios. How can I see you when you're quieter than a rabbit?" Mama Frisia would ask in turn. Eliza said, "All right," and then did just as she wanted, but she took pains to seem obedient and stay in good favor.
After a few days, she had acquired an astonishing skill for clouding reality, as if she had practiced the magician's art all her life. Faced with the impossibility of catching her in a lie she could prove, Miss Rose chose to worm her way into Eliza's confidence by constantly bringing up the subject of love. There were more than enough excuses. Gossip about her friends, romantic books they had shared, or librettos of new Italian operas, which they'd learned by memory. But Eliza never said a word to betray her feelings. Miss Rose watched vainly for telltale signs. She went through the girl's clothes and searched her room. She turned her doll and music box collections, her books, her notebooks upside down, but could not find Eliza's diary. Had she found it, she would have been disappointed, because there was no mention of Joaquin Andieta in those pages. Eliza wrote only to remember. She put down everything in her diary, from recurring dreams to an ever-growing list of recipes and domestic lore, such as the way to fatten a hen or remove a grease stain. There were also speculations about her birth, the expensive basket and Marseille soap crate, but not a word about Joaquin Andieta. She did not need a diary to remember him. It would be several years before she began to record her Wednesday rendezvous in those pages. Finally came the night the lovers did not meet at the shrine, but in the summer's home. To reach that moment, Eliza had suffered the torments of an infinity of doubts. She realized that this was a decisive step. Just for meeting in secret unchaperoned, a girl sacrificed her honor, her most precious treasure, without which she had no future. A woman without virtue is nothing. She can never become a wife and mother. Better she tie a stone around her neck and jump into the sea, had been drummed into her time and time again. She believed there was no extenuating excuse for the sin she was about to commit. She did it with premeditation and conscious intent. At 2 in the morning, when no one was awake in the city and only night watchmen were making their rounds, peering into darkness, Joaquin Andieta managed to sneak like a thief onto the terrace of the library, where Eliza was waiting for him in her nightgown, barefoot, shivering with cold and anxiety. She took his hand and led him blindly through the house to a back room, where the family's clothing was kept in huge armoires, along with boxes of trimmings for dresses and hats that Miss Rose used and reused through the years. Flat on the floor, wrapped in lengths of linen, with a drawing room and dining room drapes awaiting the turn of seasons. It had seemed the safest place to Eliza, far from the other rooms. At any rate, as a precaution, she had put valerian in the small glass of anisette Miss Rose drank before going to bed, and into the brandy Jeremy sipped as he smoked his Cuban cigarette after dinner. Eliza knew every centimeter of the house, and since she knew exactly where the floor creaked and how to open doors so they wouldn't squeak, she could guide Joaquin in the darkness with no light but her memory, and he followed, docile and pale with fear, shutting out the voice of his own conscience, blending with that of his mother, relentlessly reminding him of a decent man's code of honor. "I will never do to Eliza what my father did to my mother," he vowed as he groped his way along, holding the girl's hand, knowing that any such pledge was pointless, for he had already lost the battle with the pulsing desire that had bedeviled him since the first time he'd seen her. In the meantime, Eliza was torn between the warning voices echoing through her head and the force of instinct with all its awesome devices. She had no clear idea of what was going to happen in the room with the armoires, but she had already given in. The summer's home, suspended in the air like a spider web at the mercy of the wind, was impossible to keep warm, despite the charcoal braziers the servants kept burning during 7 months of the year. The sheets were always damp from the persistent breath of the sea, and one slept with a hot water bottle at one's feet. The only place that was always warm was the kitchen, where the wood stove, an enormous affair with many uses, was never allowed to go out. During the winter, wood creaked, boards popped loose, and the framework of the house threatened to launch itself like an ancient frigate. Miss Rose never grew accustomed to the Pacific storms, just as she never got used to the Temblors. True earthquakes, the ones that flattened everything, happened more or less every 6 years, and in each of these she showed surprising self-composure, but the daily vibrations that shook their lives left her in a foul mood. She did not like to put her china and glassware on shelves at ground level, as Chileans did, and when the dining room furniture shook and plates shattered, she cursed the country at the top of her lungs. The storeroom where Eliza and Joaquin made love on the huge bundle of flowered cretonne draperies that in summer replaced the green velvet parlor drapes was on the ground floor. They loved one another, surrounded by solemn armoires, hat boxes, and Miss Rose's cloth-wrapped spring dresses. Neither the cold nor the smell of mothballs bothered them, because they were beyond practical concerns, beyond fear of the consequences, and beyond their own puppy-like clumsiness. They did not know what to do, but they made it up as they went, befuddled and confounded, in total silence, guiding one another with little skill. At 21, he was as much a virgin as she. At 14, he had decided to become a priest to please his mother, but at 16, he had fallen into reading liberal books and declared himself an enemy of the clergy, though not of religion, and had decided to remain chaste until he accomplished his plan to move his mother from her wretched home. It seemed a small repayment for her countless sacrifices. Despite their virginity and their terrible fear of being surprised, they were able to find in the darkness what they sought. They unfastened buttons and ties, shed their modesty, and found themselves naked, sucking in each other's breath and saliva. They inhaled feral scents, feverishly put this here and that there, with an honest desire to decipher enigmas, plumb the other's depths, and lose themselves in the same soul. They left summer drapes stained with warm sweat, virginal blood, and semen, but neither of them noticed those signs of love. In the darkness, they could barely make out each other's outlines and gauge how much room they had to keep from knocking down stacks of boxes and clothes racks in the furor of their embraces. They blessed the wind and the rain on the roof tiles because those sounds masked the creaking of the floor, but the thundering of their hearts and the rage of their panting and sighs of love were so deafening that they couldn't understand why they didn't wake the whole house. Before dawn, Joaquin Andieta left by the same library window, and Eliza went back to bed, drained. While she slept, wrapped in several blankets, he had a 2 hours' walk downhill through the storm. Silently, he slipped through the town without attracting the attention of the watchman, and reached his house just as the church bells were ringing for early mass. He had planned to go in quietly, wash, change the collar of his shirt, and go off to work in his wet suit, since he had no other. But his mother was awake, waiting for him with toasted stale bread and hot water for mate, as she did every morning. "Where have you been, son?" she asked, so sadly that he could not deceive her. "Discovering love, mama," he answered, throwing his arms around her, his face radiant. Joaquin Andieta lived the torment of a political romanticism that had no echo in that country of practical and prudent people. He had become a fan of the theories of Lamennais, which he read in mediocre and confusing translations from the French, in the same way he read the encyclopedists. Like his mentor, he professed a Catholic liberalism in politics and the separation of church and state. He declared himself a fundamental Christian, like the apostles and martyrs, but an enemy of priests who, he said, had betrayed Jesus and his true doctrine, comparing them to bloodsuckers feeding on the credulity of the faithful. He was very careful, nonetheless, not to expound such ideas before his mother, who would have died of mortification. He also considered himself an enemy of the useless and decadent oligarchy, and of the government, because it did not represent the interests of the people, only the rich, as his colleagues proved with many examples in their meetings at the Santos Tonero bookshop, and as he patiently explained to Eliza, although she seemed scarcely to hear him, more interested in smelling him than in listening to his speeches. He was prepared to give his life for the pointless glory of a burst of heroism, but he had a visceral fear of looking Eliza in the eyes and talking of his sentiments. They established the routine of making love at least once a week in that same room with the armoires, now their nest. They had counted on so few precious moments together that it seemed senseless to her to waste them philosophizing. If they were going to talk, she would rather hear about his tastes, his past, his mother, and his plans to marry her someday. She would have given anything to have him say in person the magnificent phrases he wrote to her in his letters, to tell her, for example, that it would be easier to measure the intentions of the wind or the patience of the waves on the shore than the intensity of his love, that there was no winter night cold enough to damp the ever-burning fires of his passion, that he spent the days dreaming and nights awake, assailed by the madness of memories and counting with the anguish of a condemned man the hours until he would hold her again. "You are my angel and my damnation. In your presence I reach divine ecstasy, and in your absence I descend to hell. What is this hold you have over me, Eliza? Do not speak to me of tomorrow or yesterday. I live only for the instant, for the today, when I can again sink into the infinite night of your dark eyes." Nourished by Miss Rose's novels and the romantic poets, whose verses she knew by heart, the girl lost herself in the intoxicating delight of feeling adored like a goddess, failing to see the discrepancy between those inflamed declarations and the real person of Joaquin Andieta. In his letters, he was transformed into the perfect lover, able to describe his passion with such angelic spirit that guilt and fear disappeared, to give rise to the absolute exaltation of his emotions. No one had loved like that before. They had been chosen among mortals for a passion like no other, Joaquin told her in his letters, and she believed him. Nevertheless, he made love hurriedly, like a starving man, without savoring it, like someone succumbing to a vice tormented by guilt. He did not take the time to know her body or reveal his to her. He was overcome by the urgency of desire and their secret. He always felt as if they never had enough time, though Eliza calmed him, explaining that no one came to that room at night, that the Summers were both drugged, that Mama Frisia was asleep in her hut at the back of the patio, and that the rest of the servants' rooms were in the attic. Instinct provoked the girl's boldness, driving her to discover the multiple possibilities of pleasure, but soon she learned to hold back. Her initiatives in the game of love put Joaquin on the defensive. He felt criticized, wounded, his virility threatened. He was tormented by the worst suspicions, because he could not imagine such natural sensuality in a 16-year-old girl whose horizons were the walls of her home. Fear of pregnancy made things worse, because neither of them knew how to avoid it. Joaquin vaguely understood the mechanics of fertilization and assumed that if he withdrew in time, they were safe, but he did not always achieve that. He was aware of Eliza's frustration, but did not know how to comfort her, and instead of trying, he took immediate refuge in his role as her intellectual mentor, where he felt secure. When she longed to be stroked, or at least to rest her head on her lover's shoulder, he pulled away, quickly dressed, and wasted the precious time they had left, laying out new arguments for the same political theories he had repeated 100 times. Eliza felt restless after those embraces, but she did not dare admit it, not even in the deepest part of her being, because that would be questioning the quality of their love. Then she fell into the trap of feeling sorry for her lover, making excuses for him, thinking that if they had more time, a safe place, everything would be fine. Much better than their rolling about were the hours afterward inventing things that hadn't happened, and the nights dreaming of what might happen the next time in the room with the armoires. With the same gravity she invested in all her acts, Eliza gave herself to the task of idealizing her lover until he became an obsession. All she wanted was to serve him wholeheartedly for the rest of her life, to sacrifice herself and suffer to prove her selflessness, to die for him if necessary. She was so befogged by the witchery of that first passion that she did not see that her love was not returned with equal intensity. Her lover was never completely present. Even in the most rousing embraces on the pile of drapes, his mind was somewhere else, ready to leave or already absent. He revealed himself only partly, fleetingly, in an exasperating game of Chinese shadow plays. But when he left, when she was so starved for love that she was at the point of bursting into tears, he would hand her another of his marvelous letters. Then the entire universe would turn into a prism whose one purpose was to reflect her emotions. Captive to the demanding task of besotted love, she never doubted her capacity to give without reserve, and therefore did not recognize Joaquin's ambiguity. She had invented a perfect lover, and she obstinately nurtured that illusion. Her imagination compensated for the unrewarding embraces with her lover that left her in the dark limbo of unsatisfied desire. Part 2, 1848 to 1849. The News. September 21st, the first day of spring, according to Miss Rose's calendar, they aired the rooms, hung the feather beds and bedding in the sun, waxed the wood furniture, and changed the curtains in the drawing room. Mama Frisia washed the flowered cretonne without comment, convinced that the dried stains were mouse urine. In the patio, she prepared great pots of hot, strained quillet bark, soaked the curtains one whole day, starched them with rice water, and dried them in the sun. Then two women ironed them, and when they were good as new, she hung them at the windows of the drawing room to welcome the new season. In the meantime, Eliza and Joaquin, indifferent to Miss Rose's springtime pandemonium, indulged their love on the green velvet drapes, more cushiony than the cretonne. It wasn't cold anymore, and the nights were bright. They had been lovers for 3 months, and Joaquin Andieta's letters, sprinkled with poetic figures and torrid declarations, were noticeably fewer and farther between. Eliza sensed that her lover was somewhere else, that at times she embraced a ghost. Despite the anguish of unsatisfied love and the heavy load of so many secrets, the girl had regained a superficial calm. She spent the hours of the day in her usual occupations, absorbed in her books and her piano exercises, or busy about the kitchen and sewing room, not showing the slightest interest in leaving the house, although if Miss Rose asked her to, she went along with the willingness of someone who has nothing better to do. She got up early and went to bed early, as always. She had a good appetite and looked healthy, although these symptoms of perfect normality raised terrifying suspicions in the minds of Miss Rose and Mama Frisia. They never let her out of their sight. They doubted that the intoxication of love had dissipated so suddenly, but as the weeks went by, and Eliza showed no signs of distress, they slowly relaxed their vigilance. Maybe the candles to St. Anthony did help, the Indian speculated. Maybe it wasn't love after all, Miss Rose thought, without much conviction. The news of the gold, discovered in California, reached Chile in August. First, it was a wild rumor from the mouths of drunken sailors in the brothels of El Amandral, but a few days later, the captain of the schooner Adelaida announced that half his crew had deserted in San Francisco. "There's gold everywhere. You can shovel it up. They say there are nuggets the size of oranges. Anyone with a lick of gumption can be a millionaire," he reported, choked with excitement. In January of that year, near the mill of a Swiss farmer on the banks of the American River, a man by the name of Marshall had found a scale of gold in the water. The yellow pellet that unleashed the madness was found 9 days after the war between Mexico and the United States had ended with the signing of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. By the time the news spread, California no longer belonged to Mexico. That territory had been largely ignored before it was known that it was sitting on a never-ending treasure. North Americans had thought of it as Indian hunting grounds, and the pioneers had preferred Oregon, which they'd found better suited for agriculture. Mexico had considered it a wasteland bristling with thieves and hadn't bothered to send troops to defend it during the war. But a little later, Sam Brannan, a newspaper editor and Mormon preacher sent to spread the faith, went up and down the streets of San Francisco broadcasting the news. He might not have been believed, considering he had a slightly murky reputation. It was rumored that he had misappropriated God's money, and when the Mormon church asked him to return it, he had said he would, if he got a receipt signed by God.
But he backed up his words with a small pouch filled with gold dust, which passed from hand to hand, inflaming his audience. At the cry of "Gold! Gold!" three out of four men dropped everything and set out for the placers. They had to close the only school because there weren't any children left. In Chile, the news had the same impact. The average salary was 20 cents per day, and the newspapers wrote that the long-lost El Dorado had been found, the city the conquistadors had dreamed of, where the streets were paved with pure gold. The riches of the mines recall the stories of Sinbad and Aladdin's lamp. Without fear of exaggeration, the day's take averages an ounce of pure gold, proclaimed the newspapers, and they added that there was enough to make thousands rich for decades. The wildfire of greed flared immediately among Chileans, who had the souls of miners, and the rush to California began the next month. They were already halfway there compared to any adventurer crossing the Atlantic. The trip from Europe to Valparaiso took 3 months, and then two more to reach California. The distance between Valparaiso and San Francisco was less than 7,000 miles, while from the east coast of North America, passing around Cape Horn, it was nearly 20,000. That, as Joaquin Andieta calculated, represented a considerable head start for the Chileans, and the first to get there would stake the best claims. Feliciano Rodriguez de Santa Cruz came to the same conclusion, and he decided to leave immediately with five of his best and most loyal miners, promising them a reward as incentive to get them to leave their families and jump into such a risky enterprise. He spent 3 weeks organizing supplies for a stay of several months in that land to the north, which he imagined as desolate and savage. He was miles ahead of most of the reckless who set out blindly, destitute, spurred by the temptation of an easy fortune, but with no hint of the dangers and exertion involved. He was not about to break his back, slaving like a common laborer, which was why he was going to be well supplied and take workmen he trusted, he explained to his wife, who was expecting their second child, but insisted she wanted to go with him. Paulina planned to make the voyage with two nursemaids, their cook, a cow, and several chickens to provide milk and eggs for their babies during the trip. But for once, her husband stood firm in his refusal. The idea of setting off on such an odyssey with a family on his back was clearly on the level of idiocy. His wife had lost her mind.
"What was that captain's name? Mr. Todd's friend?"
Paulina interrupted in the middle of his harangue, balancing a cup of chocolate on her enormous belly as she nibbled the cream-filled flaky pastry, a recipe of the Clarissa nuns.
"You mean John Summers?"
"I mean that man who was fed up with navigating under sail and was talking about steamships."
"That's the one."
Paulina sat thinking a while, stuffing her mouth with pastries and totally ignoring the list of dangers her husband was invoking. By now she was Rubenesque, and little remained of the slender girl with a shaved head who had run off from the convent.
"How much do I have in my account in London?" she asked finally.
£50,000. You are a very wealthy woman."
"Not enough. Can you lend me twice that amount, with 10% interest payable in 3 years?
"Where do you get such harebrained ideas, woman? For God's sake, what the devil do you want with that much money?"
"I want to buy a steamship. The real money isn't in gold, Feliciano. When all said and done, it's just yellow crepe. The real money is in the miners. They're going to need everything when they get to California. They will have ready cash. They say that the steamships plow right ahead. They are not at the mercy of the wind and are bigger and faster. Sailing ships are a thing of the past."
Feliciano went ahead with his plans, but experience had taught him not to disdain his wife's financial premonitions. For several nights he couldn't sleep. Wide-eyed, he paced through the ostentatious rooms of his mansion, stepping carefully among sacks of provisions, boxes of tools, barrels of gunpowder, and piles of weapons for the voyage, measuring and pondering Paulina's words. The longer he thought about it, the sounder it seemed to invest in transport. But before making a decision, he consulted his brother, who was his partner in all his business negotiations. His brother listened, open-mouthed, and when Feliciano had set out the plan, he clapped his hand to his head.
"Caramba, brother! Why didn't we think of that?"
In the meantime, Joaquin Andieta was, like thousands of other Chileans his age, dreaming of bags of gold dust and nuggets scattered across the ground. Several of his acquaintances had already left, including one of his comrades at the Santos Tonero bookshop, a young liberal who ranted against the rich and was the first to denounce the evils of money, but who could not resist the siren call of gold and had taken off without a goodbye to anyone. For Joaquin, California represented his one way out of poverty, his only chance to take his mother out of the slums and seek a cure for her lungs, to stand before Jeremy Summers with his head high and his pockets filled to ask for Eliza's hand. Gold, gold within his reach. He could see pouches bulging with gold dust, baskets of huge nuggets, greenbacks in his pockets, the palace he would build, more solid and with more marble than the Club de la Union, to shut the mouths of the relatives who had humiliated his mother. He also saw himself leaving the Iglesia de la Matriz with Eliza Summers on his arm, the happiest bride and groom on the planet. It was just a question of daring. What future did Chile offer? In the best of cases, growing old, counting the products that passed over the desk of the British Import and Export Company Limited. What could he lose, since he had nothing to his name to begin with? He was ill with gold fever. He lost his appetite and couldn't sleep. He went around in a high heat, staring at the sea with the eyes of a madman. His bookseller friend lent him maps and books about California, and a pamphlet on how to pan for treasure, which he read avidly as he thought up desperate schemes to finance the adventure. Reports in the newspapers could not be more tempting. In one kind of mine called dry diggings, the only tool needed to pry gold from the rocks is an ordinary pocket knife. In other places, the gold is already loose, and to wash it up, one uses a simple machine called a sluice or rocker, an ordinary round-bottomed trough some 10 feet long and 2 wide across the top. No capital is necessary, so the competition is fierce, but men who were barely able to make ends meet for a month now have thousands of dollars of precious metal. When Andieta mentioned the possibility of sailing north, his mother protested as loudly as Eliza had. Without ever having seen each other, the two women said exactly the same thing. If you go, Joaquin, I will die. Both tried to make him see the countless dangers of such an endeavor and swore to him that they would 1,000 times rather live with him in inescapable poverty than have him pursue an illusory fortune and risk losing him forever. His mother told him that she wouldn't leave the hovel where she lived, even if she were very wealthy, because all her friends were there and she had nowhere else in this world to go. And as for her lungs, nothing could be done for them, she said, except wait for them to give out. Eliza, for her part, offered to run away with him if her family wouldn't let them marry. Joaquin didn't listen, however, wrapped in his nightmare of gold, convinced he would never have another chance like this, and that if he let it go by, it would be unpardonable cowardice. He put into his new mania the same intensity he had once devoted to espousing liberal ideals, but he lacked the means to realize his plans. He couldn't live out his destiny unless he could raise the sum for the passage and outfit himself with the bare necessities. He went to the bank to ask for a small loan, but he had no collateral, and with one look they saw he was as poor as a church mouse. He was icily rejected. For the first time, he considered going to his mother's family, whom he had never spoken to in his life, but he was too proud. He was haunted by the vision of a dazzling future. It was all he could do to go on with his work. The long hours at his desk became a martyrdom. He would sit holding his pen in the air, staring blindly at the blank page as he repeated by heart the names of the ships that could take him north. Nights drained away in tumultuous dreams and nervous insomnia. He awakened exhausted, his imagination boiling over. He made childish errors while all around him the exultation of gold reached the level of hysteria. Everyone wanted to go, and those who couldn't go in person set up corporations, invested in hastily formed companies, or sent a trusted representative in their stead with an agreement to share the profits. Bachelors were the first to set sail. Soon married men were leaving their children and starting off without a backward look, despite harrowing stories of obscure illnesses, disastrous accidents, and brutal crimes. The most peaceful men were ready to confront the dangers of pistols and knives. The most prudent abandoned the security won with years of daily struggle and threw themselves into the adventure with their carpet bags of illusions. Some spent their life savings on a passage. Others paid for their voyage by hiring on as sailors or signing indentures. But there were so many candidates that Joaquin Andieta could not find a berth on a single ship, even after days of haunting the docks. By December, he couldn't take any more. As he was copying the particulars of a cargo that had arrived in the port, as he did meticulously every day, he altered the figures in the registry, then destroyed the original documents of offloading. Through the art of bookkeeping sleight of hand, he caused several boxes of revolvers and bullets originating in New York to disappear. For the next 3 nights, he avoided the night watch, jimmied the locks, and sneaked into the warehouse of the British Import and Export Company Limited to steal the contents of those boxes. He had to make several trips because the booty was heavy. First, he filled his pockets with guns and strapped others to his arms and legs beneath his clothing. Then he carried out sacks of bullets. Several times he was nearly caught by the night guards, but luck was with him, and each time he slipped away in time. He knew he had a couple of weeks before anyone would claim the boxes and discover the theft. He supposed, too, that it would be all too easy to follow the trail of the missing documents and altered figures to the guilty person. But by then, he would be on the high seas. And when he had made his own fortune, he would return every last cent with interest, since the only reason for committing such a deed, he repeated 1,000 times, was his desperation. This was a matter of life and death. Life, as he understood it, lay in California. To stay trapped in Chile was to condemn himself to a slow death. He sold part of his loot at a ridiculous price in dives in the port, and the rest among his friends in the Santos Tonero bookshop after making them swear they would guard his secret. Those hot-headed idealists had never held a weapon in their hands, but they had spent years preparing verbally for a utopian revolt against the conservative government. It would have been a betrayal of their propositions not to buy the black market revolvers, especially at such bargain prices. Joaquin Andieta kept 2 revolvers for himself, determined to use them to shoot his way out if he had to, but he said nothing to his closest friends about his plans to leave. That night in the back room of the bookshop, he too placed his right hand over his heart and swore, in the name of the Republic, that he would give his life for democracy and justice. The next morning he bought a 3rd-class passage on the 1st schooner scheduled to sail north, along with a few sacks of toasted flour, beans, rice, sugar, jerked horse meat, and bacon, which, if doled out with parsimony, could get him through the journey. He bound his few remaining reales around his waist with a tight sash. On the night of December 22nd, he kissed Eliza and his mother goodbye, and the next morning set off for California. Mama Frisia discovered the love letters by chance when she was digging onions in her narrow garden in the patio, and the pitchfork hit a tin box. She didn't know how to read, but she only had to glance at them to know what she had found. She was tempted to take them to Miss Rose, because just holding them in her hand, she could sense the threat. She would have sworn that the red ribbon-tied packet throbbed like a living heart, but her affection for Eliza was stronger than prudence, and instead of going to her patrona, she put the letters back in the biscuit tin, hid it beneath her full black skirts, and with a heavy sigh went to the girl's room. She found Eliza sitting in a chair, her back straight and her hands clasped in her lap, as if she were at mass, staring out her window at the sea, so filled with anguish that the air around her felt dense and heavy with premonitions. Mama Frisia set the box on Eliza's knees and stood waiting for an explanation, in vain. "The man is a devil. He will bring you nothing but trouble," she said finally. "It has already begun. He left 6 weeks ago for California, and I haven't had my period." Mama Frisia slumped down on the floor with her legs crossed, as she did when her bones could not carry her another step, and began to rock back and forth, moaning softly. "Quiet, Mamacita. Miss Rose can hear us," Eliza pled. "A child of the gutter, a huacho. What are we going to do, child? What are we going to do?" Mama Frisia could not stop lamenting. "I am going to marry him. How, if he's gone? I will have to find him."
Ay, sweet blessed Jesus, have you lost all your senses? I will give you something, and in a few days you will be like new.
So Mama Freesia brewed borage tea and made up a potion of chicken shit dissolved in black beer, which she made Eliza drink 3 times a day. She also made her soak in sulfur baths and applied mustard compresses to her stomach. The result was that Eliza turned yellow and went around bathed in a sticky sweat that smelled like rotten gardenias. But after a week, there were still no signs of a miscarriage. Mama Freesia concluded that the creature was male and obviously had a curse on it, and that was why it clung so tightly to its mother's insides. This state of affairs was beyond her. It was the work of the devil, and only the woman who had taught her, the Machi, could deal with a problem of this magnitude. That same evening, she asked her patrona's permission to be gone for a while, and once again she walked the steep path to the ravine to stand dejected before the ancient blind witch-woman. As a gift, she took her 2 jars of quince preserves and a stuffed duck flavored with rosemary. The Machi listened to the latest developments, nodding wearily, as if she already knew what had happened.
I told you before that a fixation is very stubborn. It burrows into the brain and breaks the heart. There are many fixations, but love is the worst. Can you do something so my little girl can cast out the huacho? That I can do. But that won't cure her. She will have to follow the man. He went far away to look for gold. After love, the worst fixation is gold, the Machi intoned.
Mama Freesia understood that it would be impossible to get Eliza out of the house and take her to the Machi's ravine, let her do her work, and get the girl back home without Miss Rose finding out. The Machi was 100 years old and hadn't left her wretched hut in 50 of them, so neither was she going to come to the Summers. There was no other way. She would do it herself. The Machi gave her a slender kolige twig and a dark, stinking pomade, then explained in detail how to dab the sprig in the salve and insert it in Eliza. Then she taught her the words of the incantation that would free the creature from the devil and at the same time protect the mother's life. Mama Freesia would have to perform this ceremony on a Friday night, the one day in the week that was authorized for doing it, she warned. Mama Freesia went home very late and very tired, with the kolige and pomade under her mantle.
Pray, child, because in 2 nights' time I will do the cure, she told Eliza when she took in her breakfast chocolate.